John's Gospel, chapter 2, we've been in Mark forever, it seems, in year B, and certainly as we've been in Lent, and all of a sudden, here on the third Sunday in Lent, we take this hard turn, all of a sudden, from Mark to John, kind of out of nowhere. So we'll read it, and then I would like to entertain some thoughts and suggestions about why we switched from Mark to John, kind of out of nowhere. All right? So who would be willing to read verses 13 through 22? 13 through 22. Okay, great.
The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers at their business. After making a whip of cords, he drove them all with the sheep and oxen out of the temple, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things away. You shall not make my Father's house a house of trade." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for thy house will consume me." The Jews then said to him, "What signs have you to show us for doing this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews then said, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he spoke of the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. All right. So, thoughts about why switching gospels all of a sudden? Anything?
This is a time that it should be presented.
Okay. So this particular story, I think, has timely relevance. What about the story makes sense as far as being in Lent?
Cleaning,
cleansing, the house of God, the zeal, all those things that, you know, if our bodies are the temples of the Holy Spirit, then maybe, like the temple that Jesus cleansed, we ought to be clean. And, you know, Lent's a good time for that. Good, yeah. What else?
References those to come.
That's right. So he makes a prediction about the crucifixion and the resurrection. It is less clear than last week. But I think that because these allusions to what will happen next are significant in Lent, that we've switched from Mark, who had one, to John, who records one that Mark doesn't. So this one is more obscure. Last week, if you remember, in Mark, he tells the disciples, "Look, I'm going to be turned over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will kill me." And, "Oh, no!" But, I mean, he was, like, as specific and detailed and clear as he could possibly be, and they were still, "Duh, I don't know." So this one is more obscure, but it's also quite interesting for kind of a different reason. So let's start back at the beginning. It's almost time for the Passover. Now, Jesus is going to Jerusalem, so the temple is in Jerusalem. This is the second temple. This is not Solomon's temple. Solomon's temple was destroyed when the southern kingdom fell. It was rebuilt, you know, years later after that exile and they come back. But it is still the center of worship for Jews. Now, where are Jews living at this time? Where do they tend to be?
All over.
Yeah. So they've sort of spread out. The geographical term is diaspora, dispersed. So when the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom were conquered, a lot of people were carried off, a lot of people were driven off, a lot of people just kind of left. And so all in that sort of Middle Eastern area, Jews moved around and started to set up their lives. Now, the Southern Kingdom is restored and a lot of people start coming back. But a lot of people got sort of settled where they settled, and they felt pretty fine about that. So in the culture right now, who's the dominant player? What nation is in charge?
Rome.
Rome is. Now, what are a couple of things Rome is known for? Okay. So that's really...
Dominance.
I thought you said boats, but you said roads, and that's exactly what I was going for. They're basically known for... positive-wise, they're known for laws, and they're known for roads. There are Roman roads that still exist in Europe. Mm-hmm. And roads that the Romans set up, that those same routes have been adopted by, you know, highways and all that kind of jazz. What does a good road system do?
Put things together.
Yeah, so people can travel, and you know, things can happen. Yesterday we were trying to get to Tampa, and the traffic was really bad. There was the accidents on I-4, and so we wanted to take an alternate route, so we wound up taking 60, and it was horrible. It was horrible. Normally 60, though it's a little bit longer, is clear, and this time it wasn't. It was way backed up, and there was at least 3 accidents, and it took us 2 hours to get to Tampa.
Sounds like an average day in Miami. Hmm.
So, if we were reduced to taking back roads, how often would we travel to other cities?
Not very often.
Yeah.
But provided it's not jammed up with traffic, what do things like the Polk Parkway and I-4 allow us to do?
Get there faster.
Yeah. It's a little more direct route, and it is much quicker, especially than, you know, going through little towns and stoplights and stuff. So, the Roman roads have allowed this Jewish diaspora, who have now scattered all over the place, to move pretty easily and to get back to Jerusalem for the important festivals and holy days. All right, so this is important context for a particular reason. People are coming, Jews are coming for the Passover. And they're going to the temple. And these aren't just the Jews who live around Jerusalem. These are all the out-of-town Jews. These are all the Jews who moved far away but can now use a Roman road to get back. So, if you have traveled in order to make the Passover, which has, you know, sacrificial elements to it, and you're from far away, what are some things you might need to do as you arrive in Jerusalem?
Drink
money. Mm-hmm.
You know, if you live out in Macedonia somewhere, and you've got Macedonian coins, but you need to either exchange them to Roman money or maybe Jewish money. The temple even had like specific coins that it used for the temple. If you didn't live locally, you had to do that when you got into town. If the temple is the center of sacrifice, where in the Mosaic Law there's a whole system of animal sacrifice for different things. These sins or these thanksgivings, this cleansing or this act of gratitude, and it might be a dove or a pigeon, it might be a sheep or a goat, it might be a cow, blah, blah, blah. So if you traveled to get to the temple, what else might you need to pick up on the way?
Your
sacrificial animal. I mean, what kind of pain would it be to travel 300 miles with a sheep that's in really great shape and perfect just so you can kill him? You know, that's a pain in the rear. So that's the context for what we read. People are traveling from all over to get back to the temple for a holy celebration. And so they are exchanging money, and they are buying animals for their sacrifice. Now this, the guys changing the money and selling the animals did not make up the system. All right, this is, you know, laws of Moses are involved here. So somebody really did need to be able to supply, you know, lambs and pigeons and all that kind of jazz. What was the problem?
Jesus didn't like that. That was the big problem, setting up business.
What about it did he not like?
Okay.
What are the three most important rules of real estate? Location, location, location. Okay. Is it wrong for people to provide animals for sacrifice when the Mosaic law demands sacrifice?
No.
Is it wrong to exchange money for travelers who are coming out of town and may need to either spend it or wish to donate it to in the temple treasury, or they're trying to buy those sacrificial animals, but they're not, you know, if you've got all these different denominations, you have to have some sort of common coin. Is there something wrong with that?
No.
So what seems to be the problem is where? It's in the temple courts. The temple courts would be almost like putting it in the narthex. Okay? So in the church, in the sanctuary, we've got, you know, you walk in, and it's really the same building, it's just a wall. But you sort of walk in, and that's where you can get your bulletin, and, you know, people chat it up. But then once you walk through the doors into the nave, the main seating area of the sanctuary, don't things kind of change?
Yeah, you're exploiting God for...
Well, I mean, in the narthex, you know, a clap on the back and a chit-chat, and, oh, it's great to see you, that's one thing. But once you walk through those doors...
Yeah,
it's like this holier, you know... and some people still do the chatty, back-slapping thing, and other people get frustrated because they're in there to pray quietly, and that's kind of an ongoing issue. But the thought is that the narthex is kind of that... It's an entryway. It's a vestibule. It's a
transition place.
Transition place, mm-hmm. Greeting area, foyer, whatever, that is connected to but separate from the quieter, holier, more respectful area. Now, imagine the commerce of people from all over trying to get coins exchanged. The commerce of people from all over trying to buy the appropriate animal for the specific sacrifice. Try to imagine the noise of these animals. And imagine it in the narthex. Okay? So the temple courts, it was actually outside the temple, but the temple didn't have a narthex. You know, basically this courtyard area, the colonnade, the patio that goes right into the temple. Can you imagine being in the sanctuary and praying quietly, and someone comes into the narthex and starts yelling and shouting, and, you know, one of those people who can't control their volume, and they're laughing really loud, and hey, how you doing? Or maybe they start having an argument with somebody. How do you feel inside the sanctuary when all that's going on? It's very disruptive.
Yeah,
so crank that up, you know, to 10 or 11, and that's what we have going out, you know, right outside the temple, which is supposed to be the holiest place. And on one of the holiest days, the Passover. So, you ever exchange money? Anyone? Like you go overseas or something? It's pretty easy these days. As a matter of fact, since, you know, like credit card companies, your debit cards, they will do the transactions automatically. And that, you know, used to be a lot more complicated. You know, you go somewhere and you have dollar bills and you exchange them for drachma, you know, whatever. On our honeymoon, we had traveler's checks. You say how long ago this was. It was 20-something years ago. So we went to Curacao, which is a part of the Dutch Antilles. And to make sure that we had some, you know, cash, we took these traveler's checks. Like, in, I think they were in 20s. And we were in this little marketplace, and we found this oil painting that we wanted to get to kind of commemorate the trip. And so it was like $35 or $30, whatever it was. And so we're trying to buy it, and we got $40 in traveler's checks. And they're like, oh, no, I can't do that. And so it causes this whole scene where you can just keep it, you know, we don't need the change. And she's, you know, she's fussing, and she winds up, she's so committed. She winds up giving us this really pretty gaudy, like, fake carved out of wood machete with a toucan painted on it. Like, here. So that evens us up. I mean, imagine people, and they're probably arguing, and they're haggling, and they're debating, and I think that my money is worth this much, and you're only going to give me that much, and, you know, money changers who are dealing with stuff from all over, maybe they're not the most honest of people, and maybe they are trying to get a little bit extra. So all these things are going on, and this is the house of God. So what does Jesus do?
He gets mad.
Yes, he does.
First time ever.
Yes, he does. Well, I don't know if it's the first time ever, but it's definitely the one we have recorded here. So he makes a whip out of cords. That's basically like, it was either bits of rope or bits of vine or something else, but he kind of ties them together so they're fairly substantial. And he's coming in there and he's knocking stuff over and he's tipping over tables and he's whacking this whip around. That sound much like Jesus to you? This seems out of character and out of place. Most of our images are, you know, humble Jesus, meek and mild. How do we make sense of this scene?
It's that important.
No, they're violating the house of worship.
And knowing that is human.
Are there some things worth being angry about?
Yeah.
Legitimately.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was one of them. It fulfills a scriptural prophecy about the, you know, the zeal for your house will consume me. But there's some things that, you know, sometimes we get mad at stuff and it's petty or it's selfish or it's, you know, it's
foolish.
Trivial and foolish.
Yeah,
but
I
would say 99% of the time our anger is more about our irritation. But every now and again something happens and anger is appropriate. Somebody threatens your child, what do you do? Oh, there, no. There are some things that are worth getting mad about. So Jesus does this. We know that he does not sin. So there is some way for him to express that anger that is A, directed appropriately, and B, handled appropriately. Everyone who is Jesus, raise your hand because you get to do this and not sin. Okay. So it's not impossible for us to be angry and act with that anger and not sin. I would just say, I am really not good at it. Is anybody else better at it? It's a hard one. Jesus does it, so I think, again, it establishes that anger itself is not sinful. It's neutral. There are times where it's appropriate and there's times where it's not. And even acting in that anger, this is righteous indignation, but not in the way of kind of that huffy, that we can say is righteous indignation. This is the true thing. This is the real deal.
Well, isn't it that these people didn't understand that this is the Son of God and you are insulting him?
Well, but I think this was the insult was more for the temple and more
house.
For the presence of God. Mm-hmm. You know, even if Jesus wasn't there, but he knew it was going on, he would have been angry. So, you know, there's a line. And, you know, we blur lines all the time these days. Culture pushes for blurry lines and everything is shades of gray. But every now and again, maybe we ought to bump up into lines that are real and are solid, and at the edge of the gray there is black and there is white. And this was one of them. So, I will say this is why I always get a little twitchy with coffee shops and bookstores inside of churches. You know? I don't know that's exactly this, but it always feels a little too close for comfort, which is why we don't do that. So, what happens next? The people say, who the heck are you? How dare you mess everything up here? Which actually seems kind of appropriate. I mean, this guy goes nuts and start. I mean, this ostensibly goes on all the time. This is not new with the animals and the money changing. So then this guy comes in and he wrecks it all. And so what's the response of the people around?
Why are you doing this?
Yeah. Why are you doing it? And more than that, who do you think you are? What is your authority? Who gives you the right to do this? And what is Jesus' response?
You say he'll destroy it and then he'll raise it up.
Right. 3 days.
Okay, so destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. You want to know what my authority is? Well, destroy this temple and I'll raise it in 3 days. That will give you your answer. Now, what do the people hear when he says that? What do they think?
They don't know who he is.
They don't know what it means. They think
the building. And they're like, you're a crazy person. This thing took us, you know, nearly 50 years to build. And if you're telling us that you're going to rebuild it in 3 days, then clearly you are a nut job because it can't be done. But what is Jesus talking about?
Himself.
This is the temple of my body. Crucify and kill me. And on the third day I will be raised again. A glorious resurrected body, never to die. And then your question about who am I and how dare I do this will be answered. So, does some guy who just gets a itchy trigger finger have the right to disrupt everything in front of the temple? Maybe, maybe not. It kind of sounds like he's taking things into his own hands, and it's vigilantism, and it's probably not a good idea. But if you are the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, as demonstrated through your resurrection, do you have the right to do this?
Yes.
Yes, you do. You do. It will be demonstrated through his death and resurrection that he is the begotten Son, that he is the resurrected Lord, he is the Christ, he's the King. So ultimately, whose temple is that?
It is.
Whose house is that?
Yes.
And who has the right to clean things up at their own house?
Yes.
Well, that is basically why I think we took this detour to John, when it is that it's happening. That as we are considering Lent and we're still working through it, number one, another death and resurrection prediction. But also number two, you know, I really like what you said about the cleansing element. If the house of God is not just the temple, it is our sanctuary. If the house of God is not just our sanctuary, but it is ourselves, how should we be treating things? Don't treat them so casually. Don't treat them with such a utilitarian, whatever works and whatever makes things easier. But the temple, like our sanctuary, like our lives, ought to be holy, for they are the property of God, bought and paid for through the cost of His own Son. We good?
Good.
Yep. All right.